Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Ahead, more college students need campus mental health services, but they're not always getting the help they need. What's the problem? We'll hear more. We'll talk with a man who has committed to being a role model for young people, despite a difficult upbringing. Chicago officials are having to navigate an influx of asylum seekers. That includes making sure they have food. Also, a homeless advocate explains what she's doing to help people in Springfield. We'll also learn about an alternative burial practice called water cremation, and hear how a father of a special needs teen found a way to give him and others jobs. With the movie Oppenheimer getting accolades, we'll visit the University of Chicago, which played a key role in the development of nuclear weapons. Those stories and more coming up this hour on Statewide. Welcome to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Many students on college campuses, especially those of color, are having a hard time mentally and emotionally, but they often hit a brick wall when trying to get help. Asian American students in particular are most affected. Lisa Currian Phillip brings us the story of one who reached out for help and never got it.
During her sophomore year of college, Isabel Dizon hit a low point. Her freshman year had mostly happened on Zoom because of the pandemic. She left, worked for a year, then switched schools. It was a lot. She decided to turn to her campus counseling center. It's listed on every course syllabus at the University of Illinois at Chicago. That's where Dizon goes to school. Students can get short-term therapy there. It's paid for by a health service fee charged to all students. Despite the promise,
I called them a couple times and it all went to voicemail. I also emailed. There was never a response.
Dizon put herself out there, asked for help, and got radio silence.
It was kind of just like, well, you're all on your own and you have to be tough. I just wish they picked up so that I would just not have to go through something like that.
Dizon felt like she didn't have anywhere else to turn. She's Filipino-American, so
there's the cultural barrier of having my parents not believing in mental health issues. If I were to reach out to my doctor, be like, hey, I might need help, my parent would love to them, but like frown upon me.
Most Asian American college students with mental health concerns didn't get treatment in the previous year. That's what a survey of more than 70,000 college students found. Advocates say there is stigma around getting help in some students' communities, especially those of color and from immigrant backgrounds. But they say that's not the only and not the main obstacle to getting help.
There are people who want to access mental health resources. There are just so many barriers to accessing it.
Allison Kung is an assistant director at UIC's Asian American Resource and Cultural Center. She was a student at the campus more than a decade ago.
Unfortunately, I would say that things have only gotten worse. UIC for a while was continuing to expand or accept more and more students, which I think is great on one hand, but the amount of resources were not expanding with the rate of the students.
Kung says a lot of students, not just Dizon, have a hard time getting help from the counseling center. The university says it currently has 24 providers, including some trainees. That's to serve more than 29,000 students. Kung says students who are struggling often turn to her, but she says,
there's only so much I can do as a non-mental health professional.
Kung says she can refer students to therapists off campus, but not all of them have insurance or other means to pay for them. Or they may not have time to find a provider who's a good fit because they're working and taking care of family members.
It's difficult to have this extra burden of navigating this system. Like, it feels like purposefully difficult.
In 2019, Illinois lawmakers recognized an urgent need for more mental health services for college students. They mandated public campuses, including UIC, beef up what they offer through peer support and partnerships with off-campus therapists. But the state has so far provided a fraction of the 23 million government forecasters say is needed to make it work. In the meantime, students like Dizon are forced to get creative. She's now a junior. She says she leaned on friends after being ghosted by the campus counseling center.
It ended up being fine, but I can't keep doing that.
She doesn't want to overburden her friendships.
That's what the medical professional help is for. Being able to hold on to someone who's trained to listen to your issues and then help you walk through it. Then you can go back to your friends and have healthier relationships with them.
UIC leaders promised $4 million more over 6 years for mental health services to help bring an end to a faculty strike last year. Dizon hopes some of that money is used to hire people at the counseling center to, at the very least, pick up the phone.
That was WBEZ's Lisa Korean Phillip, who joins me now. Isabel's story is just so frustrating to hear. I'm a parent of college-age kids, and we know how hard this pandemic era has been for a long time. I know the state has taken some action to improve mental health services for college kids. Why is this still an issue?
Yeah, so lawmakers passed legislation in 2019 that a lot of people were like praised. They were like, oh, this is so ahead of the curve. We're really trying to look at mental health for college kids in a preventative way. But the thing is, it was subject to funding appropriations, and that really hasn't been there. It went for a couple of years without any funding at all, and state government forecasters have ask colleges, how much do you need to make this happen? And they say about $23 million. And right now, this year, current year, it's getting $12 million in funding. And for the next year, Governor Pritzker is proposing $4 million in funding. And without consistent funding, they can't do things like hire extra providers, because if the funding's not there next year, how are they going to pay their salaries?
So these shortfalls in money and these shortages of people to help them, it's really affecting students on campus, it sounds like.
Yeah, so students who have mental health issues are dealing with things like depression and anxiety, they're much less likely to graduate. And a big reason for students dropping out is emotional and mental health distress.
And just to pull back, this demand for services, mental health services, has really blown up, hasn't it?
Yeah, for sure. I think part of it, again, is like we mentioned, the pandemic. It was so stressful for students to start in this weird environment. And students like Isabel, you know, especially students of color, they may not be able to go other places to get help, or, you know, maybe they can't afford private treatment. So campuses are really the place where these students can get help. And right now, that help isn't really there.
Lisa Korean Phillip, a higher education reporter, she spoke with Mary Dixon. Shamar Betts is a young man who had a difficult upbringing. He witnessed horrific violence as a child. Years later, he spent time in prison for inciting a riot in Champaign in the wake of the George Floyd murder. Today, Shamar is 23. He lives in Urbana, and he's committed to turning his life around. The Illinois Student Newsroom's Madison Holcomb reports he hopes to be a positive role model to young people. And a note to listeners, this story contains descriptions of violence.
When Shamar Betts was a kid, he says his mom worked hard to shelter him. She wouldn't let him hang out with the neighborhood kids or go to the store or to the park alone. She signed him up for activities like chess and band. Shamar says his mother was his best friend. But his mom's life was cut short. She died of a heart attack when Shamar was just 12. They were driving in a car together at the time.
When we approached the red light, she like put it in park, she knew. And she was like holding on me and just saying like she loved me and stuff. Call the police, call the ambulance.
He doesn't remember much from that time other than feeling really depressed. Without his mom, Shamar says he quickly learned why she tried to shelter him. He was walking out of a corner store with a friend one day, and a car sped past. A passenger pulled out a gun and shot into a small crowd of people across the street. He says he watched as 5 or 6 people fell to the ground while the others ran or crawled away.
At that time, like, the way it looked, it just seemed like a movie.
Shamar started hanging out with more kids from his neighborhood. He'd watch as they threw rocks at cars and shot Roman candle fireworks at one another. His mom's voice in his head made him want to stay out of trouble. He also realized he had the power to make better decisions.
I have a choice to pick and do what I want and not just survive.
At the end of 7th grade, Shamar and his sister moved to Mississippi to live with their grandmother and aunt. But Shamar struggled to get along with his aunt, and he no longer felt challenged in school. So he moved to Urbana to finish high school. Shamar graduated and got jobs with the Urbana Park District and the Don Moyer Boys and Girls Club. He was excited to start college in the fall of 2020. But in May of that year, Shamar, who was 19 at the time, made a decision that would change his life. News of George Floyd being killed by a white police officer in Minneapolis had started to spread. Shamar watched the viral video footage of the killing and was immediately enraged.
My first instinct, selfishly, I guess, was just thinking as a black man, how easy that could have been me, how easy it could have been one of my loved ones.
Shamar attended a peaceful protest in Champaign-Urbana a few days later, but didn't think it had much impact. When his brother in Chicago sent him pictures and videos of riots there, Shamar got an idea. A riot would be more impactful than a peaceful protest. Shamar created a flyer the next day, which contained a photo of a cop car on fire and the words "Riot at Marketplace Mall." He posted it to Facebook and said it received hundreds of shares. He says he got to the mall, gave the A-OK to the crowd, and they began vandalizing and looting stores. Police arrested Shamar a few days later. Sitting in court, he says he realized what he'd done.
After sitting in jail and listening to them bash me so much in court, I realized the wrongness. I realized what I did wrong completely. I realized what I could have did better.
He'd spend the next year in jail, followed by almost 2 years in federal prison. Shamar says he used the time to work on self-improvement and make plans to get his life back on track. He's grateful that 2 months after he got out on probation, he received a call from a man named Tracy Dace. He's the founder and CEO of the local nonprofit Dream, which provides mentorship to young people. Dace says one of Shamar's mentors reached out to him while Shamar was transitioning out of prison. Dace says he saw it as a sign.
I'm a person of faith, and I was like, well, maybe God is trying to tell me something, right, that I need to connect with this young man. And so I'm very happy I did. He's a very intelligent young man, and I've enjoyed working with him.
Dace gave Shamar a job at Dream, where he helped drive kids to and from the after-school program. This year, he's stepping into a new role as an achievement coach, working with fourth and fifth graders. Shamar says he looks up to Dace.
He's actually a big role model to me. He's very involved with the community, very aware of the things that's going on, and actually wants to make a change.
Today, Shamar says he's focused on his goals. He wants to study psychology and become a guidance counselor to mentor kids who grew up in similar situations as he did.
Just try to show them the things that I learned or could have learned, like things that I wish I did differently, and help them stay focused, give them an opportunity, kind of like Mr. Tracy do, to pull them out the streets and clear their minds in different ways.
Shamar says he regrets the harm caused by the riot. But overall, he says he wouldn't change anything about his life.
I don't want to do a replay. I don't want to really change things because each of those situations helped make me who I am, led me to some route that led to another.
I'm Madison Holcomb, Illinois Student Newsroom.
The epic movie Oppenheimer won several Oscars, including Best Picture. Hollywood's interest in the history of nuclear weapons has some key connections to the University of Chicago. Robert Lorzel takes us on a walk through the Hyde Park campus to find out more.
There's one other thing I want to point out over here.
I am on campus on a recent morning with John Mark Hansen, a political science professor. He's taking us on a tour, stopping at some spots where atomic history was made.
So this is where the race for the atomic bomb began in 1942.
We are standing in a Gothic-style building on the campus's main quad. Hansen has researched the history of the nuclear scientists who lived and worked here.
We're currently in Eckert Hall, as the home of the mathematics department at the University of Chicago. So this is room 209. It looks pretty similar to what it did at the time. This is where the top program leadership in the metallurgical laboratory held their regular meetings. A brigadier general named Leslie R. Groves, Jr. was here to talk with the leadership of the lab about what was going on here. Robert Oppenheimer actually was visiting for this occasion at the time. And so in the morning, they talked about what was going on in Fermi's project to split the atom.
Enrico Fermi was a physicist who'd fled fascist Italy. Now he was in Chicago, working on building the world's first nuclear reactor. Hansen leads me north on Woodlawn Avenue to a three-story brick house. This is where Fermi lived.
The Fermi family, they were very generous hosts and entertainers. So they would invite people over for food and for drinks, and they would play records and they'd play games. They even had a book club that they hosted here in their homes.
We walk a few blocks back into the heart of campus by the library. In 1942, this is where workers were constructing a pile of uranium and graphite under the grandstands of the university's old football stadium.
So we're at the corner of 57th Street and Ellis Avenue. In 1942, this was the site of Stagg Field. What is here right now is Regenstein Library.
Standing near the library, there's an abstract sculpture with a curved, blobby shape. It marks the spot where Fermi oversaw the world's first nuclear chain reaction on December 2nd, 1942.
And at 3:25, Fermi orders George Weil to remove that last of the three control rods. And then as he watches the various instruments, he's putting calculations through his slide rule, and finally looks up and he says, "It's exponential. It's gone critical."
Hansen praises the Oppenheimer movie for sticking close to the historical facts. But he says it missed out on some big drama in Chicago.
The film focuses on the moral agony of Robert Oppenheimer when, in lots of ways, the real leadership in conscience within the Manhattan Project was here at the University of Chicago.
Robert Lorzel with that report. This is Statewide. There's more ahead. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Chicago has been figuring out how to feed thousands of migrants over the last year and a half. City officials and local agencies took on the difficult task of feeding large crowds of people, mostly from South America. And as they try to strike the right balance, there have been many lessons learned along the way. Adriana Cardona-McGigot has the story.
The Greater Chicago Food Depository distributed meals to migrants when they began arriving on buses, then across police stations, and later across 21 shelters. Amy Laboy was in charge of much of that endeavor.
We ensured that every shelter that we worked with had milk and coffee, breakfast cereals, fruits. We were definitely providing dishes that involved rice and chicken.
Laboy says throughout the whole process, her team tweaked the menus and their strategy to figure out the right balance between nutritious meals and something people were used to eating.
Lots of meetings, lots of phone calls, lots of strategy, lots of making sure that vendors had capacity to do what they needed to do, that they had the information that they needed.
The depository hired restaurants, including Black and Mexican-owned businesses, to cook. Together, they provided 20,000 hot meals daily at around $6 to $8 per dish. The agency spent more than $17 million with state and private funds. Rodel Castillo was one of those vendors. He co-owns Garifuna Flava, a Caribbean-style restaurant on West 63rd Street. He constantly asked for feedback from shelter staff.
We did our own census on a day-to-day basis. When we take something in, we'd ask them, you follow up, you know, how did it go, how did it go? And then we were able to determine what we needed to kind of change.
Sometimes, he says, migrants like the food. Other times, they said that some meals were too spicy. He had to hire more staff, shop for food in bulk, and quickly develop a menu. He delivered more than 500 meals daily.
Several hundred pounds of rice per week, several hundred pounds of beans per week.
Castillo and his family are from Belize. They learned a lot about Venezuelan cuisine and how different it can be from Mexican and other Central American regions. He quickly figured out a key ingredient that most Venezuelans love.
Plenty of mayo. So we were buying literally buckets and buckets of mayo.
That's true, says Gerardo Abreu. He co-owns Sabor Azulia, a Venezuelan restaurant on the northwest side. Standing in the middle of his busy and smoky restaurant kitchen, Abreu points to chicken breasts sizzling on a grill. He says Venezuelans are used to eating hearty meals with meat, rice, and salad, plus plantains, potatoes, and stews.
Se come la salsa como tomar agua, la mayonesa. Se comen cantidades industriales.
He says they consume mayo like drinking water. He doesn't have a contract with the city, but volunteering efforts to feed migrants at the start of the migrant crisis.
Nosotros al principio, en las primeras oleadas, ayudamos mucho.
He says they figured out how to cook on a budget for tons of people.
Y pensamos, ¿no? Que sea económico y que sea mucha cantidad, pues, porque la idea es que alcance para bastante gente.
One idea was rice.
Otra cosa fue el arroz.
With shredded chicken mixed in and a simple salad. No condiments, no peppers, no spicy food, and more salt than usual.
Que es un plato a lo mejor muy tradicional con una ensalada que es muy sencillo, muy básico.
La Boy with the Chicago Food Depository says they adapted in their menus and cooking style much of what Abreu is talking about.
Not so spicy. Vegetables not on the side.
She also came to the conclusion that most migrants love another condiment besides mayo. Ketchup.
Oh, that was a huge learning.
Yes, putting ketchup on spaghetti is quite popular. Adriana Cardona Magigad, WBEC News.
An historic crematorium in St. Louis has been vacant for years, but it will soon get a second life for an alternative burial practice, becoming more popular. Sarah Fintum says it will become one of that region's only locations to offer alkaline hydrolysis, which some call water cremation.
It's a frigid day in January, and funeral home operator John Hughes is watching a team of heavy machinery movers use a crane to maneuver a 1,900-pound steel tank off a flatbed truck.
Yeah, I'll take everything loose right here. Okay.
The tank, about the length of a small car and the shape of a submarine, needs to fit through a small door at the bottom of a 140-year-old crematorium on Sublet Avenue. Built in the 1880s and closed since the 1990s, the historic building in South St. Louis is now back in action.
And so we're really, if anything, just proud to take a building that was just sitting for literally the past two decades empty and bring it back to life.
The tank is used for alkaline hydrolysis, a method of preparing bodies after people die. Some people call it water cremation or aquamation, but unlike traditional cremation, it doesn't involve a furnace. Instead, a worker places a body in a steel tank along with the potassium hydroxide solution. The tank is heated to around 200 degrees Fahrenheit, which breaks down tissues and dissolves the body. After 6 to 8 hours, only bone fragments are left. Hughes says the process mimics what happens when a body is buried underground.
What takes nature, you know, anywhere from 2 to 20 years takes hours here in our machine. And at the end of the process, you get the same mineral bone ash back as fire-based cremation.
He's one of only a handful of people in the region who offers the service, but the process is becoming more popular as people become interested in environmentally friendly burial practices. Historians say funeral and burial rituals have always changed throughout history. The Missouri Historical Society's Amanda Clark organizes a 2-hour bus tour in the area called Beyond the Grave, which showcases how death practices evolve over time. Clark explains the crematorium building Hughes is moving into was one of the first in the country. She says when the first cremation was done there in the late 1880s, people were fascinated.
The local newspapers, not only did they covered it in detail with diagrams, and you can tell it's very intentional. And I like to think, you know, the whole thing with cremation is kind of letting go, like dropping that veil and making it less scary and less, you know, strange.
She says Hughes offering a new style of burial in the old building makes sense.
To meet someone, Young as well, who's just head on, like going into this and like has a respect for the space, but also is bringing it really into this modern space as well, is fantastic.
She and Hughes think alkaline hydrolysis, which now accounts for only a tiny fraction of burials, could see a boost in popularity in the years to come, just like cremation in the 19th and 20th centuries.
It was practically unheard of back then for cremation. Very, very few people got cremated. Most everybody was buried. Now, in the state, for every 10 people that pass away, 5 or more will be cremated. And that's just going to rise as the years go on.
We'll go ahead and take the rail out.
At the crematorium, it takes the movers around 4 hours to glide the alkaline hydrolysis tank through the stone door and into the basement of the 140-year-old building.
So how do you feel right now watching?
I'm okay. We're hanging.
The team finally guides the tank to the corner of the crematorium's basement. Hughes fiddles with the touchscreen on the side of the machine, and the tank hums to life.
That's what it's supposed to sound like?
It's supposed to, yeah. It's all.
The tank is now up and running in its new home. Hughes says he respects that alkaline hydrolysis isn't for everyone. But as history has shown, there are always people interested in trying something new. I'm Sarah Fentum, St. Louis Public Radio.
Many parents of special needs kids wonder what their children will do when it comes to getting a job. One Chicago father aims to tackle the problem one cookie at a time. Esther Yoonji King reports on Al's Cookie Mix.
Got your gloves on, Jess? All right.
In a commercial kitchen in the Beverly neighborhood, Alvin Green is packing cookies with his employee, Jasmine Glover.
So we're going to try to fit as many as we can on here, right? Mm-hmm. Looks like we can get about 4, okay?
Today, this duo is packing 2 kinds of cookies concocted by Green.
Oatmeal raisin with dark chocolate and cherries. And then we're doing a brown butter bourbon pecan and chocolate chip cookie.
I tasted the latter, and let me tell you, it was so delicious, I don't think I'd get much packing done if I were Glover.
Do you ever sneak one and eat it while you're packing?
No. I can't do that. I don't want to get fired.
Glover has Down syndrome, and she's one of Green's dozen or so part-time employees with special needs.
They're all our kids. I say, they're all my angels.
The 57-year-old Green has a salt and pepper beard and an easy smile. The father of 2 young men worked as a caterer for many years. Green's 20-year-old son, Aiden, has autism and currently attends Southside Occupational Academy High School.
We were thinking since he was elementary school, what to do next. And my wife, she's like, combine your 2 loves, your love of baking cookies and your love for Aiden and his friends. And so Al's Cookie Mix was born.
As a parent of a special needs child, Green always wondered what opportunities would be available to his son when he left school. He says there's some job training programs out there and things like Special Olympics, but he felt he and his family could contribute opportunities too, right in their own community.
Usually when the kids age out at 22, there's never enough programs or work opportunities for them to have jobs.
Now Green knows that employing people with special needs requires more than just hiring them and signing their paychecks. You have to be mindful of workers' needs and triggers. For example, sensory issues like noise and stimuli, space for a wheelchair, whether a worker is verbal or not. Aiden, for example, prefers sealing the cookie wrappers and putting labels on them. Early on, when Green announced the business opening, he heard from a number of people just in Beverly alone who said, I got a kid. They're sitting at home.
The need for employment opportunities is a lot greater than what we can supply right now.
For Green, Al's Cookie Mix is a way to help others. But it is also a legacy for Aiden.
He understands that this is his company. And so he says, this is my company. This is for his future. So he gets that.
Green calls Al's Cookie Mix an online gourmet customizable cookie company.
You pick your base, vanilla, chocolate, oatmeal. You go through our list of mix-ins. I think we have about 20 now. So you pick what you want. We say, you mix, we bake, we ship.
That we, of course, includes workers like Glover.
What's the best part about working here?
I like our cooking mix.
I'm a great boss, right?
Yes.
I gotta give you extra pay for that one.
Glover is one of Green's angels, and he hopes one day Al's Cookie Mix will be able to hire a kitchen full of them.
Get in there, Josh.
Esther Yunji Kang, WBEZ News.
Got your sheets? Let me get this dried for you.
The gray fox is a unique animal. It's the only canine in North America that can climb trees. Yet while it can be found across much of the U.S., gray fox populations have plummeted in other parts. And as Rachel Kramer reports, researchers in several states, including Illinois, are trying to find out why.
Along a wooded ravine, Dave Hoffman, a technician with the Iowa Department of Natural Resources, pulls an antenna and radio receiver out of the back of his truck. At first, he just hears static. But then...
Can you just hear the signal beep? That's their gray fox dialed into a frequency.
Hoffman and other DNR staff put a tracking collar on a 10-pound male gray fox, known for short as GF1, last November. The equipment Hoffman's using today helps him get within range of the fox and his collar so he can download several weeks' worth of data.
So this will kind of tell us about his den sites and particularly the habitat that he's using here.
Gray foxes are small, about the size of an average house cat, and like cats, they can climb trees. Their rotating forearms and hooked claws help them scoot up trees to escape predators and to hunt. While gray foxes can be found from southeastern Canada to northern Venezuela and Colombia, these nocturnal, somewhat secretive animals prefer to avoid people. Still, in Iowa, state biologist Vince Evelsizer says there's been a noticeable decline in gray foxes over the last two decades.
And it's to the point now where it's pretty big concern because the population is so low that we're at risk of even losing the species of wildlife out there.
He says the DNR has tracked a downward trend with historic harvest data and more recent wildlife surveys. Biologists from Illinois, Indiana, and Ohio also have noticed a similar decline. Now, agencies in all four states are conducting gray fox studies and planning to share their findings. From there, they can figure out what may help gray foxes rebound. Indiana DNR is the furthest along with a four-year study that wraps up this summer. Project leader Darian Albers says they saw worrying trends with gray foxes.
We are hearing some concern from the public, especially from like licensed trappers, that they weren't seeing them anymore where they used to. And that kind of spurred us to start looking into it. And then put some funding toward this big research project to try to understand what was going on.
Indiana partnered with Wildlife Ecology Institute, a nonprofit based in Montana, to radio collar gray foxes and collect tracking data. Technicians also collected blood and tissue samples for disease testing and genetic analysis. Don Redding, an associate professor of biology at Luther College in Iowa, is leading the lab work. While there's still a lot of data to go through, Redding says the highly contagious canine distemper virus is a big concern.
Canine distemper virus seems to be a major source of mortality for gray foxes in our study area. And, you know, this is important. They're not the only species that can get canine distemper virus.
Coyotes, raccoons, skunks, and domestic dogs and cats can all spread distemper, although it's not clear exactly how the disease is reaching gray foxes. Researchers are also looking into habitat loss and competition with other wildlife as possible causes for the gray fox decline. Coyotes are known to be a threat to gray foxes, but a recent study from North Carolina suggests the two can coexist if there are enough trees for gray foxes to climb. Lead author Ariel Parsons says those findings could extend to the Midwest.
Because we're all seeing indications that coyotes are playing a role, but clearly habitat is also an important factor, and likely there's an interaction between the two.
Loss of woodlands to suburban development and agriculture could be a factor. Studies in the Midwest will help determine that. And Parsons says she's excited to see more research into the gray fox.
They've been a background species, but now we are seeing, boy, you know, this species that has previously been fairly common and that we've ignored is starting to decline, and that's a red flag.
Parsons says it indicates that we may be missing something that's affecting other wildlife not just gray foxes. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Rachel Kramer.
We'll be back with more of Statewide in a moment. You're listening to Statewide. Thanks for being along with us. Schools have a lot to offer. Classes, special education programs, sports, and so much more. But what about small schools that can't offer everything? Many smaller, often rural schools resort to one of the first lessons they teach, sharing. Peter Medlin reports.
Jennifer Wald starts her day teaching exploratory and intro to agriculture at the Leland School District, a small rural district in LaSalle County, and she teaches both middle and high school. Then, after a few classes, she gets in her car and drives 6 miles east to teach more high school ag and advise the FFA club at the Samanok School District. Wald is a shared teacher, and she wears both a Leland and Samanok lanyard to prove it.
It's interesting because it's 7 minutes apart, but it is a completely different dynamic.
Shared teacher setups like this aren't very common, but Leland and Samanok already work together, so it made sense. They share sports teams and a food vendor. In fact, Leland and Samanok almost completely consolidated last year. The districts also share classes, like agriculture, so when Wald comes to Samanok, so do some of her Leland High School students. In fact, students from a third district, Sandwich, also come to Samanok for ag. It allows those districts to offer their students classes like plant science, food science, and ag mechanics that they otherwise couldn't. Class sharing does happen more frequently at smaller, often rural schools. Tim McConnell is the principal at Erie High School, a northern Illinois school about 20 minutes from the Mississippi River. They've had a sports co-op with nearby Prophetstown High School since the late 90s. But 5 years ago, they expanded the co-op to include everything, sports, activities, and academics. McConnell says the decision made a lot of sense for both sides, especially considering one factor.
Well, our school enrollments, both in Prophetstown and in Erie, are steadily declining. So when I came here 22 years ago, as the principal, we were at 250, and now we're down to 190.
The districts build their schedules together, so if an Erie student wants to take a class that their school doesn't offer, they can take it at Prophetstown, and vice versa. They both offer dual credit opportunities students at either district can take. McConnell says as enrollment at districts like Erie shrink, and it becomes more difficult to hire certain teaching positions, arrangements like this are going to become even more common.
This type of education is going to only have to expand, or, you know, students are going to be left without. And so people need to get on board with it and not be afraid of it. It's easy to do if you, you know, have the passion to get it done.
Brian Dukes is the superintendent of the Earlville School District in LaSalle County, and he says collaboration is one of the most valuable tools he has in education. He'll borrow a good idea from anywhere. Earlville works with other districts on curriculum and various school programs. They also share school support staff with neighboring districts. For example, they've had a hard time filling their school psychologist position, so now they share a psychologist with two other districts. The district also shares a school resource officer and a special education coordinator, too. Duke says it allows them to maintain high-quality services and save some money.
I think it's very likely there's going to come a time in the next 2 or 3 years that we're going to have to share teachers with other districts.
Back in Samanok, Jennifer Wald agrees that sharing teachers can be a great opportunity for certain school districts. But in her own experience, there are some drawbacks.
Last year, I had to work spring break because Leland and Samanok spring break did not match up. And because I'm the only shared employee, no one, it's almost like sometimes that gets forgotten.
This year, she will at least have a spring break. Well, maybe not a whole spring break because of FFA.
I got it this year. Yeah, I'm going to run a contest, but that's my fault.
And sometimes she feels torn between districts, like she's not 100% a part of either. She has to miss staff meetings moving between schools, but thankfully has co-teachers in both spots to keep her in the loop. And she feels like even though it's not a perfect system, it does increase her ability to create unique and meaningful education experiences for her agriculture students at all our schools. I'm Peter Medlin.
Advocates for children with severe disabilities are at odds over how Illinois should fund special education day schools. Mawe Iqbal reports.
Public school districts can place students with special needs in day schools. These are separate facilities for kids who can't learn in a general school setting. The district pays for the students' tuition at these schools and are then eligible for state reimbursement if the kids are in private day schools, but not public ones. State Senator Meg Loughran-Capel's bill would change that.
With this bill, the focus is on the needs of the students and not how a district is going to be reimbursed for that placement.
Opponents say there isn't enough state money to go around, and districts would only get partial reimbursement at most day schools as a result. I'm Mawa Iqbal.
Julie Benson of Springfield has been helping the homeless in her community for 8 years, and a little more than a year ago, she decided to open first one, then another sober living home as a way of getting people off the streets. She spoke with Maureen McKinney about the venture.
I have two of them. They're not far from each other. They're fairly close to downtown. Just a little over a year ago, I was speaking to a gentleman who owned the first one, and he's in his 90s, and his family was encouraging him to retire. And I was trying to get somebody into his house, and he said, oh, by the way, I'm going to sell it. He said, I'm really hoping to get somebody who will keep it as a sober house. And I got off the phone with him, and God's whispering in my ear again. And I prayed about it and slept up overnight about it. And I woke up the next morning and I said, why not me? And so I bought the first house and I almost filled it up the day I signed the bank note. Because people in the community knew who I was getting phone calls. I heard you've got a sober house. I need to get off the street. So I almost filled it up. And then I had so many men that kept calling me that I was putting on a waiting list, and I thought, I don't have enough to do. Why not a second home? The day that I signed the paperwork, 30 days later, I had it filled up. They have a lock on their door. I'm the only other person that has a key. They have privacy. They all have TVs. They all have beds. I provide Wi-Fi and free laundry service in the building, and then I bring in food. I'm not just collecting rent and being a slumlord. The houses are clean. They're all happy to be in there. Some of them came off of the street. Some of them came from prison. Some of them came from other sober houses. Some of the other ones, they have to share rooms, and in mine, they don't. And, I've learned over time about drug addiction. I had somebody actually ask me recently, what was your drug of choice? And I said, I never had a drug problem, and I never had a drinking problem. I just evolved from helping the street people, which I still do. But for me, this was a way to help people get into housing and get help. And the transformation for people is, it's unbelievable. I have seen these 19 people do wonderful things with their life, and I'm happy to be a part of it.
Are they the same people as the ones you initially
started?
When
I started, no. I have had to evict some people. I'm also a Social Security disability rep payee for 20 people. And some of the people that I had in my first building were some people that I was a rep payee for, and it didn't work out. They still had drug problems and other problems. One of the rules in my lease is that you can't have anybody stay all night. You're not supposed to have women stay all night. It's not an apartment building. And the rooms aren't big enough really for two people. I have in my lease also that the lease renews every 30 days. I have a guy who's been there 9 years and then another guy who's been there 13 years now. I have no intention of trying to make them move for any reason. Probably half of them are on disability and half of them are working. And they're all walking their own journey.
So you don't have a time limit on how long someone stays. It's just whether there's a problem.
Whether there's a problem or they want to move on.
Uh-huh.
But I have rules. No drugs, no alcohol, and no excuses. I'm a stricter landlord than I am stricter with people on the street.
Mm-hmm.
I've got to put my landlord hat on. You got to pay rent or I can't keep the place is going. Mm-hmm. And you're benefiting from the houses, you know, being self-sufficient. I don't get any government money for either. So I've got Helping the Homeless in Springfield, Illinois, which is a 501c3. That is a charity. And that is the outreach for the people on the street. And that is where I do my Social Security Disability Rep Payee work. And then Home Sweet Home Sober Living is a business because I collect rent.
Do you see that there's overlap between the people who are homeless and those who need sober living? Do they tend to be the same people?
Oh, sure. Oh, sure. Absolutely. Drug addiction and for whatever kind of maybe other trouble that they were in and had to go to prison. You put people back on the street again, they're just going to get in trouble one way or another with drug addiction, with alcohol addiction, stealing things. There's all kinds of other kind of criminal elements. I have seen people are healthier when they're in a place. Many of them have, we joke about it, many of them, since I've been in this house, I've gained weight. Well, you probably needed to, mm-hmm. You're eating better, you're sleeping better, you're safe, there's camaraderie. And when you've got a community of people who are coming out of prison, coming out of drug rehabilitation, being on the street, they know each other. And they try to help each other. When they start on that path of living a sober life, they go to church, they go to AA meetings, they go to NA meetings. They're trying to get involved, trying to help other people, trying to talk to some of the other ones that are on the street. When are you going to bottom out and care about yourself? And that's really what it boils down to, is they have to care about themselves first. It's hard to help somebody who doesn't want to help themselves. I had a guy who's been in my first house for a year, and four spots. I had one room left, small room. He was sleeping at the library on concrete for several years and was doing that whole tough guy thing. And I convinced him to come in, get into the room. He's had a couple of setbacks here recently, and I have a pretty high threshold for not kicking somebody out the first time. I don't believe that that's a solution for anybody. So I've had discussions with him, and I said, you're pretty close to getting evicted because you've gone off the wagon several times. You've gone to rehab several times. I can't help you unless you help yourself. And he, from a year ago, I don't know if I want to get in. I don't know if I can do this thing outside, Now, a year later, he's saying, please don't evict me. A transformation. It's a mental thing, and it's a physical thing to get them off the street or some of them, when they come out of prison, they have to have an address. So they cannot be homeless. They have to have an address, because the idea from coming out of the court system is that we don't want you to come back to prison. So first thing is, got to get into housing. And I get calls from guys all the time needing to get in. And, I attribute the success of the house to two things: that I have found people that want to help themselves, and therefore this is their home, and that they don't want to go back to what they were doing before. I mean, some of them have some pretty heavy backgrounds, and I don't discriminate against anybody. I don't. My only thing, when somebody approaches me or calls me and wants to get into the house and I've got a spot open, Do you want to live a sober living life? And can you pay rent?
That's Julie Benson of Springfield. She talked about the sober living houses that she has opened in her community. We're out of time for Statewide, but we'll be back with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois next week. Remember, you can find our episodes where you get your podcasts through the NPR app and at nprillinois.org. If you have a comment about the show, drop us a line. We look forward to hearing from you. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.